Hi guys, Nick here from Conservation Careers and welcome to the podcast. Now, meetings are a core part of our working lives, and yet studies have found that 50% of time spent in meetings is often wasted. When viewed as a whole, that's billions, if not trillions, of dollars wasted annually, which could be put to much better use. But why do we spend so much of our precious lives clogged up in a confetti of mediocre meetings? With calendars full back-to-back, often worn as a badge of importance, rather than being seen as a problem to tackle. Here to talk about meetings and their untapped potential for productivity and transformation is today's guest, Dr. Carrie Goucher. Now, Carrie is founder of Fewer, Faster, Bolder, an organisation which believes meetings are a huge white space for improvement and understands that they matter so much because people spend so much time in them. In today's inspiring pod chat, we discuss the problems with meeting culture at the moment and how we got to where we are. We also discuss what incredible meetings can look like and how to create ones for yourself, including practical steps on how to invite people, how to start a meeting, and how to capture what's discussed, agreed, and parked up. As a successful entrepreneur herself, Carrie also kindly shares her advice for budding ecopreneurs, people with a passion and purpose and an idea that could deliver profit and purpose in the world. It's a meeting transforming and impact creating pod chat. Enjoy.
I'm Carrie Goucher, and I am the founder of Fewer, Faster, Bolder.
Perfect. Thank you, Carrie. It's so lovely to have you on the podcast. I've been looking forward to this chat for quite a long time, and we've known each other for about 10 years now. We can talk a bit more about it towards the end, but we're here to talk about something that's really close to my heart, which really is, well, it's specifically about meetings, and that's what Fewer, Faster, Bolder is all about, improving meetings, having fewer, faster, and bolder meetings, and we can explore that in much more detail. But to me, it's about like how we use our time most effectively, I guess, within our work, within our careers, within our lives, you know, to have more impact. And you've been doing lots of research and creating new methodologies about how we can kind of transform meeting culture. So lovely to have you on here. It's a hugely important topic inside conservation as the movement, but also more generally in other sectors too. So let's start with meetings and, you know, the current situation of meetings and why we should even care about meetings. Like what, let's start with that. Like, why should we care about meetings? Like, you know, why are meetings important to us?
Meetings are the recurrent events we go to all the time. Whatever job we do, we probably go to some meetings. Mm-hmm. In many of the jobs we now do as knowledge workers, working on an increasing scale, so working on more complex projects, more collaborative, working across the world or across divisions or functions, we inevitably spend more time talking to other people in meetings. They are a huge source of frustration for many people. They are, one of my coaching colleagues says 80% of the frustrating scenarios that her clients bring to her in her sessions happened in a meeting. And they are that combination of being incredibly important. So they signpost what matters to the organization, whose voice is heard, how we're going to get stuff done. They're really important cultural events, and yet they're massively under scrutinized. So there's very little that we're formally taught about how to do meetings well, how to capture the kind of human side of it, how to make progress. And what happens is two things I'm told all the time. One is I'm in back-to-back meetings. I haven't got time to think or work. And the other thing I'm told all the time is there's so much talk, we just sit around, big discussion, too little action, too few decisions, unclear, and I leave no further forward than I was before. And we have to raise the bar on this.
Mm. And you describe it yourself as like it's a huge blank canvas for change. Mm. And I'm sort of reading the kind of the words used around a clog of meetings, a confetti of meetings. I think there's a sort of a good description of how we often feel about meetings within the kind of modern workplace. Yeah. And also I think attached to the kind of the back-to-back meetings idea that you kind of shared, that I think there's often a feeling that once you're in these meetings and you're very busy, it's generating work in the background, more to-dos, and you've got less time to do those to-dos, and your inbox is filling up, and it all coalesces around this kind of frustration that, well, that it's being caused 80% of the time by these instances.
That's right. So many people are in collaborative overload. So as you say, it's not just meetings, it's email, group type chat, direct message. We're ending up in each other's WhatsApps at work as well. It's a never-ending attempt to get people's attention and focus. You get this very dysfunctional behavior. So I know one organization I've worked with where because you could not get people to respond asynchronously any other way, they wouldn't answer an email, couldn't get them on group chat anymore because they were all in meetings. The only way to get them to do something was to book a meeting with them. And that which further perpetuates the drama. So the simple fact is, it's nobody's fault. It's just the way the system has evolved. The kind of work we do requires the depth of conversation, depth of relationship, and the cross-functional conversations that draw a lot of different people in. And we just haven't developed a sophisticated enough method for streamlining, for handling all of this. And that's where my work has been focused really over the last 6 or 7 years.
Where's all this come from? Like, how have we got to where we are as a kind of modern, developed culture? One would think we should be better at this by now, because it is
No.
incredibly important. But like, how have we got here?
Yeah, there are a few, I think there are a few things at play, and that's the question I ask myself all the time. Why aren't we better at, why haven't we solved this problem yet? And it's something I talk to organizations quite a lot about as well. So when organizations decide they want to do something about meetings, what they usually do is say, well, we just need to make sure that we have some meeting rules, we have an agenda, we start and finish on time, make meetings small, no bigger than two pizzas, whatever that means, and we start putting rules in. But the problem is that doesn't solve the problem either. So, and the reason is because we're not addressing exactly as you say, how did we get here? So a very fascinating snippet from the history of meetings is in the Middle Ages, the word meeting was a euphemism for a physical duel. So reaching a decision through violence, and over time, the idea of restraining from violence and battling instead with words through meetings became a sign of power and status. So the meeting was born, and over centuries, meetings have gone hand in hand with the civilizing of society. And I think we see an element of that now where we feel the number of meetings we're invited to, and the volume of our diary becomes almost a badge of honor and a badge of worth. And if I'm not invited to lots of meetings, am I important? Am I valuable? So that is pulling us, it's driving us into more and more meetings. And of course, as we mentioned earlier, the way that we work has changed. So whereas previously our economy was based on the production of tangible things, sourced and locally, at least compared with today's global markets, and it might be complicated, the production chain, but they would be basically known in advance, and provided you did them right, the end product would be correct. Well, that's not true anymore. We don't have this kind of value generation based on specialization, hierarchy, control, processes. Now, the products we create are based on knowledge, data, pixels, they're sold globally, and the rate of innovation is so much higher. So we need to make or improve something every week or every month, not every decade. Now, that kind of product is not optimized through specialization and hierarchy control, but through collaboration, through networks, through experimentation, through empowerment and autonomy. And all of those things are drawing us together into meetings to get stuff done in a way we just didn't need it 60 or 70 years ago. Now, all that said, meetings have not improved either in that time. So though we're going to more, the kind of satisfaction with meetings and the perception of how much of that time is valuable hasn't improved in decades. It sits at about 50%. So the thinking is 50% of the time we spend in meetings is not useful. And that number is not improving. So we are lagging behind in our technique and our mindset.
I find it absolutely fascinating. And this idea, historically, meetings is more of a conflict and a duel, and you can sort of still sense that in a modern meeting, that we have a problem, an issue, a disagreement, therefore we should come together and discuss that. That makes sense, but it's sort of from a conflict rather than a collaborative perspective, rather than a kind of working together
Yeah.
perspective.
Now, I believe in a collaborative world, conflict done really well is the new collaboration. So the place we've also arrived at is we've become incredibly conflict averse. Again, driving more people into meetings, let's see if we can get more people involved and bring more people on the bus with us and make sure we're taking in everybody's viewpoint into account. And that being inclusive in meetings and drawing people in is great, but the overuse of that strength becomes conflict avoidance and over collaboration. In fact, conflict is discovery. We need to disagree really well around tasks. That's how we keep things safe. It's how we make new discoveries. It's how we make progress when we surface tension, conflicts and tensions between goals and priorities. When we do that really well, that is how humans do amazing things together at work. So instead of moving away from conflict, we need to move towards it, but to do it really well and around the task rather than making it interpersonal or relationship conflicts, which is how we often hear it and see it at work. And we're so afraid of either creating or experiencing interpersonal conflict that we're afraid to go near the crucial task conflict as well.
And I think a theme that's going to emerge is this idea of culture. I mean, I've read again words from yourself about meetings are where cultures show up, and I think that's so insightful, actually. It says a lot about the organization, the hierarchy, the expectations. And it really comes to bear, doesn't it, when kind of people get around a table, and particularly when there's kind of conflict in the table and how that's managed.
Exactly. So I see, we can easily say, well, it doesn't matter what you put on the values chart in reception, as you say, what really matters to the organisation is what shows up in meetings. That's the kind of negative framing. All your dysfunctions will come out in meetings, true. The positive framing is meetings are a fantastic container in which to enact change. So if you are a manager, and you want to change and improve the way your team works, virtually every dysfunction in your team can be addressed with meeting technique, I believe. So if you want people to be more empowered, or what you really mean is take responsibility and accountability, step up. The number of managers I talk to who want their people to really step up to the mark. If you want people to equalize voices, so to let other people speak up and perhaps step back a bit if there's somebody who talks more. All these team dynamics can be somewhat engineered through meetings. So it's a really fruitful place as a manager. Likewise, if you're an individual contributor, meetings are a fantastic place to show how valuable your contribution is. And I talk about, you can lead a meeting from any seat. You don't have to be the person who put it in the diary, and you certainly don't have to be the most senior or highest paid person in the room. You can show your leadership in many different ways, and I hope we get to talk about some of those.
Well, let's talk about could you like maybe paint a picture as like what an ideal meeting could look like? We've sort of touched on a little bit about how things are and issues and symptoms and causes. Let's sort of crunch gears into, okay, so what does a good meeting look like? So maybe you could just give like maybe an example, or just sort of bring it to life, give us some color as to what an amazing meeting actually is.
Okay, so let's imagine we're working on a cross-functional project. We've reached a milestone. We need to bring some other people in because we're going to need their input over the coming months. And those people haven't been very involved so far, and you need to come them to come and work with the people who have been involved. So a kind of classic scenario. And typically what would happen is you'd receive, if you were somebody who hadn't been involved in the project, you would receive an invite in your inbox, go straight in your calendar, and that's probably the first you'd have heard about it. And there'd be l little or maybe zero detail in the email invite. and even the name of the meeting may not give you a clue. So the first thing we're going to do in a great meeting is send a cracking invitation. So tell people exactly what you're trying to do, a tiny bit of context, why you need them, what you want them to do, and what a good outcome looks like. And the crucial bit there is tell them what you want them to do.
Yeah.
So we're all about ourselves. What do I need to do? What do I need to come ready to do? What's expected of me? How can I contribute, etc.? That's what people really want to know. So
that's at the individual level, would it be, Carrie? So like, Carrie, I'd like you to do this, and Bob, I'd like you to do that, or
I would go to that level of detail. You might, if in a different type of meeting where you wanted everybody to do the same thing, then you might not need to go to that level of detail. But I have an example of that in a LinkedIn post I wrote a few months ago, where I show you visually exactly how I do that. And it does say, Bob, can you dot, dot, dot? Laverne, can you dot, 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 et cetera. And I think because we operate at such an individual level, that's a real Western culture thing, isn't it? Like, I'm here in my company doing my thing. That is the unit that we're interested in often. And that is how to appeal to people. So it's a judgment call, how much detail to put in. But yes, plenty of times I would specify that. And for the sake of an extra 60 seconds to write five bullets for those five people, I think that's well worth it. What you're also doing is you're inviting people to play different roles and to value each other's role. So you might say, Bob, I'm hoping you will come with your compliance hat on and help us navigate the red lines we need to know about. Well, that's a great invitation for Bob to be able to do the job he's paid to do without being kind of shot down as a naysayer. So you can just start to craft the dynamic with the invitation.
I love that. Yeah. I guess it also, as you as the person organizing it, it makes you reflect on who needs to be there and why they're there. And if you're struggling for a bullet point for someone or a role for someone, it makes you kind of reflect, do they actually need to be in this meeting or not? Yeah.
Yeah, it does. It fleshes all of that out. And often you want somebody to come for a reason you're not quite happy to voice to them or perhaps to other people. And that might flag up another conversation that needs to happen or something you want to be a bit more transparent about. But as you say, the intentional act of thinking about what you want people to do forces you to think about, what is this session for? Meeting time is premium real estate. It is the highest intensity time we spend at work. It's the highest value time, you know, 7, 8, 10 people, and the cost of their salary, their attention, all together in one place, focused on one thing. One person says something, another person says something, another person thoughtfully replies to that. It's a slow process. We want to make the absolute best use of that.
Yeah. And the other thing, I'm sorry, I think I cut you off there as well, was around setting an outcome, like what you're looking to achieve in the meeting. Is that right, when you put that invitation out?
Yeah, setting an outcome. And again, you can make this inspiring and interesting. So Priya Parker, who is the absolute expert in gatherings. So she talks about all kinds of gatherings, certainly not just meetings, but, you know, crucial social events and life events and so on. And she talks about how we want to invoke people's enthusiasm and touch on something that matters to them with a bold, sharp intention and an outcome that they really care about. And I know that sounds very lofty for a team meeting. However, I do think with a bit of thought and imagination, everybody cares about doing a good job. You know, the people in your audience, people listening to this podcast, there is no one who cares more about impact and doing a good job than people who are working on something related to our planet and, you know, the and its inhabitants and its longevity. And finding a way to make people feel their time is going to be well spent is really, really powerful. And all of this pre-stuff sets us up with some boundaries. It sets up a good social contract. It's something you can repeat again at the start of the meeting, so people know, understand what container they're in, what pop-up team they've just landed in, having just finished a, rapidly finished a sandwich or just left another meeting. And you're giving fantastic orientation so that people can do a brilliant job together very quickly.
Love it. Love it. Before we jump into the meeting and describe what a good meeting looks like and how it could function and how you can create that safe space, do you have, and you might not, I'm sorry, but do you have like an example outcome or a title of a meeting, that people could use? Because I like the idea of being creative with me. It's not just budget review or I don't know, executive management team. Like you're brilliant at creativity, like in words. Have you got any examples of great meeting titles or outcomes that were used?
Yeah, so let's try a few out for size. So I like using a question. Rather than budget review, you might have how can we safeguard and maximize our spend this year or something like that, or more enthusiastic words. Often in adding a bit of informality helps. So you could say making the absolute most of the resources we have in 2024. Which is not a not often not the language we would use. We might say it, but we wouldn't write it. And I would encourage you to write what you would say. You can also you could have a purpose for a meeting, which is as simple as how's it going? So if that's the tone you want to set, that this is a really informal space where there's no pressure, we're not reviewing your performance. We're just trying to support each other and give people a space to, it's a team, weekly team session where people can share their wins and concerns and so on. Then you can invoke the spirit of that through the type of language that you use. Or you could give it a really concrete purpose, like to tunnel a path to break even.
Ooh.
Or,
Nice.
give it a metaphor or give it something that again helps people understand what kind of contribution you're expecting. Or I've run meetings with a purpose like how can we make it easy to work together? So a question is another nice format to use.
Fantastic. Well, let's talk about the meeting itself then. So we're creating this amazing meeting. We've sent an invite out, being really intentional with who we've invited. We've given them clear roles and start to set their expectations around that. We know what an outcome is. We're quite excited by the outcome. We've landed in the meeting. How could it function to make the most of that time we've got together?
So many things I'd love to say here. So let's keep it to the absolute essentials of what I think goes into a the bare essentials that let me rephrase that. So what are the core things that will make a massive difference, are easy to do and completely accessible, whatever job you do right now? So we often stumble over the beginning to our meeting. We kind of it's I wonder if it's a British thing or a meeting thing, I don't know, but we kind of there's a bit of, oh hi, I think we've got everybody, okay, well let's just get started. And we might have even planned to say something a bit more to set the scene a bit, and then we kind of trip over it and we don't want to make a big fuss about it. But the beginning of the meeting is again prime real estate, and it's the perfect opportunity to do two things. So one, set the context, revisit exactly what you want people to do in the session. Check that people agree with the purpose and that they're happy to contribute. Check if they've got any questions. And then to start by getting everybody to contribute as quickly as possible. So ideally, in the first 3 minutes of every meeting, everybody should have said something. And in reality, that is a round. Doesn't have to be, but that's one really easy way. Could be you could get people to type into the chat. You could do ask people a question and ask them to answer it in turn. And the thinking behind this is it sets the tone that everybody's voice is equal, and it allows everybody to open their mouth, use their vocal cords, say some words, and we know from studies that once you've said one thing in a meeting, you're far more likely to say something else. And if you go a long period of time in a meeting and you haven't said anything, you're far less likely to pipe up when the meeting comes. So it's a really effective way to set the space. And you can also use it to gather some useful data really quickly. So it's not just a kind of, oh, what's everybody's favorite cake? Haha, you know, like an icebreaker. It's a way to get some important views or check-ins or data into the room really quickly that you need. It's a very efficient way to do that, so you can then discuss them.
Yeah, love it. On a practical point, if someone prattles on for 5 minutes in that very quick round the table, we've all had that, you know, just quickly
Oh, yeah.
introduce yourselves or whatever, and actually you get a life story as an example.
Yes.
What couldn't you do as a chair, and should you do anything to, you know, somehow bring them back in and keep it just to that 3 minute icebreaker?
Yeah. So the first thing I would do is at the start, I would tell people how long this bit's going to be.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
It's going to take you 2 minutes to answer the same question together. So most people can do the mental arithmetic on that. I might give an indication of brevity. So I might say in two words or in one sentence. Now, I said that to somebody yesterday and they gave me five sentences. So you often have to give people a far shorter boundary than, or you know, container than you think they're actually going to use. I might model it myself. So I'll go first, dot 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 dot. I know there are people in the room who will just struggle to do that. Concision is not their thing. And so then I take a view. I might flag it up when I pass it over to them. So I might say, might re-emphasize, Josh, in one sentence, tell me X, if even if I hadn't repeated that prompt for somebody else. And if one person went over, often a lot of people go over, then I would, as I pass it to the next person, I would say, Ishmael, same question, but shorter, please. And I would also accept the complete imperfection of humanity and that this takes some practice and it comes more easily to some people than to others. And I just allow a little bit more time for it in my meeting plan than I'd actually said to them.
Yeah, brilliant, brilliant. And just to kind of acknowledge and recognize also, I've been in lots of meetings earlier in my career when I was less confident, maybe, where I was increasingly conscious that I've not said anything. And
Yeah.
it's a really
Yeah.
hard barrier then to suddenly break into that room
Yeah.
and into that space. And you sort of get more and more anxious about
Yeah.
suddenly speaking, you know, and sort of
Yeah.
making your presence or your lack of presence aware, you know.
Yeah.
So it is a good technique actually to try and say something early in a meeting, even if you've got the chance just to settle in.
Yeah. And that's where, you know, that's exactly what the word, and I hate the word icebreaker. Or ice melter, as we sometimes call them now. But it's very hard to break through that ice. And as you say, your voice feels strange and high. And you feel like, you know, everybody's watching you when it's 40 minutes in and you just pipe up with something. So just make it a non-issue. Just get people to use their vocal cords in the first 3 or 4 minutes. And then that job is done. And they're way more likely to contribute.
Brilliant, brilliant. Right, we've done the icebreaker, we've contributed. What next?
What next? So use some kind of structure that signposts the stages that you're going to go through in the meeting. There are very few conversations that don't follow some kind of flow. And the problem we get is when we've all assumed that flow is different or a different stage of it. So a classic example is you're in a problem-solving meeting. There's a big discussion. It's got no structure to it. So you've got one person saying, well, I think we should just do this. This is the answer. One person's already generating solutions. Another person is saying, well, I don't even know how we got here anyway. So I don't even, you know, like, how did this happen? And somebody else is kind of critiquing somebody else's ideas. And you've just got a complete mishmash. And what we really want to do is to separate it out and say, okay, first of all, we're going to make sure we've completely understood the problem here. If how it happened, if that's relevant, what's going on, the scale of the problem, and make sure there's no misunderstanding between us about that. We're not going to worry about solution, we're not even going to generate any ideas at this point. We're just going to understand the problem. Then we'll come on to making some ideas. And finally, we'll work out what we're going to do. Then when you get the next stage and you've understood the problem, then you could say, now let's start to think of some options. What could we do about this scenario? What options are on the table? And again, you'd flag up, we're not going to make a decision at this stage. We're not even going to evaluate any of them. I just want to know as many options as possible so we know what we're dealing with. And then finally, right, now let's look at what we've got there. So even just that, the lightest of structures, simply by breaking it into stages and giving a verbal signpost at each stage, suddenly people are flowing in the same direction and can start to contribute together. And we're not getting that interpersonal conflict, which is, hang on a minute, I'm generating some ideas and they're getting knocked down already. That's how we get, that person doesn't value my ideas. And we're avoiding all those landmines that we end up in all the time.
Yeah, so you're sort of like laying the tracks for direction and giving people a journey to go on that is going to give them a chance of success. What I like about that also is like separating out like creative options and solutions to almost like critiquing and then making the plan. I think in the brainstorming is probably the wrong word nowadays. Thought showering, whatever. I mean, it comes back to like a Walt Disney idea I heard about where they had a dream room and like a nightmare room, and all the executives would go in the dream room, and any idea goes. It's all positive. You don't knock anything down. Just let one idea spark another. Then we take all the ideas into the nightmare room and see what stands up at the end of it. And just having that separation allows good ideas to bubble up and be judged later.
I love the idea of making that a physical room.
Yeah, me too. Two separate spaces entirely. So we've gone through the process, and just reflecting back also, it's quite similar to coaching. I've been doing some little coaching practice recently and learning more about coaching and this idea of creating a safe space, having almost like a grow model where you have a goal and then the reality, and then your different options, and they're wrapping up into what you're going to do next. It's just it, it there's lots of crossovers within all this, which I find really interesting.
Well, it's funny you say that because there's a whole module in my e-course which is around how to use a coaching style as a meeting. So all my meetings, I have deliberately drawn in a number of coaching techniques. So you're absolutely right to spot that. Very deliberate parallel.
Wonderful. That's good. Yeah, I can really see the benefits here as well. Anything else you want to kind of talk about regarding to like, having an optimal meeting? So we've gone through the processes. Are we on wrap up or after, or where are we?
So there are a million things that you can do in that session, and it is, I find it very difficult even to kind of edit it down for my 3.5 hour e-course, which is full of all these techniques. However, assuming that you've done some great stuff in the middle, whatever that was, the final part is to capture the value of what you've done. I see a lot of meetings with really bright, nice people doing really creative, interesting things, but failing to capture and embed the value of what they've done. The simple way to do that is to keep three lists through the meeting. So one is for decisions. So ideally, this list is on the wall, or it's in the chat, or it's on a digital whiteboard, or whatever. One is for decisions, one is for actions, and one is car park. We often capture actions, but we don't often capture decisions. And decisions are really the things that other people outside the meeting want to know about. And they're also the things that completely get forgotten after the meeting. So by capturing those, you can amp up the value of what you've done in the meeting back in the real world. But equally, you can use it as a bit of an inquiry. So as a discussion's taking place and it sounds like there's a resolution in mind, you can say, is that a decision? Shall we write that down? So it's a way to sharpen what is going on in the meeting itself. When we're in that natural state where we know, the thing that happens in meetings is no one often wants to, some people do, but mostly people don't want to enforce their view on another or impose their thoughts on another. So we use a lot of suggesting and proposing styles like, oh, we should really dot, 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 or maybe we should think about dot, dot, dot. And you can, which is fine, but at some point that needs cleaning up. And that is where the decision log is really helpful. If it isn't a decision, then it needs to go into the car park because that's something that will need to be dealt with later. Might not be the right time to make that decision. And then it goes into the car park. And then clearly actions can go in to the action list as well. And those three things form quite a complete package of, it's the simplest, lightest set of things you can capture and still translate what happened in the meeting into value back in the organization.
Okay. Decisions, what you decide to do, so you don't forget them as well. You don't need to talk about them again. It's been decided in many respects. Actions, so we're clear who's going to do what and by when and all that useful stuff. And car park, allowing to kind of put things to one side and not forget them
And
and
not forget
circle back
them.
later. Love it. Okay. Let's talk about fewer, faster, bolder then. So you started this new organization. It's been off the back of research that you've been doing as a PhD. Now graduate at Cambridge Uni, looking into kind of systems and processes and really focusing on meetings as a problem. That's something you have a corporate background into, like in your career. What is fewer, faster, bolder, and how can it help people?
Well, I guess the name comes from the idea that those are the three things we need to do. So we need fewer meetings. It's very hard to improve meetings if you're in so many of them. You've barely got time to have a glass of water between them, let alone think of a creative purpose to put in for the invitation. We also need to, many of them, where they need to be faster. And we also need them to be bolder. And by that really goes back to this idea of helpful disagreeing and helpful conflict around a task. We need more candor and a strong space in which important but often inconvenient conversations can be had. So that's where the name comes from. And though I am massively fascinated by every individual meeting I go to and every individual meeting I hear about and all the ones I run and attend, there are a lot of people doing work on individual meetings. Though I do have my own meetings course, there are other courses you can go to if you want to be a brilliant meeting facilitator. The work I do is at an organizational systems level. So if you are a leader of an organization, a CEO, a divisional head, a change manager, somebody in HR, and you're like, we need to do something about all these meetings, then it's me that you would work with to work out how to address meetings as a cultural, structural systems problem. The reality is, the way we do that is by starting a whole load of small useful experiments with a particular part of the organization, with particular people in the organization. So it starts at a very, very practical level, but the way we are addressing it is designed to be scalable and to create a ripple effect and change across the whole organization.
That's really interesting, like how you start change from a small area, and I guess where you choose that change to start from, and how that then allows to expand within and embed within the culture of an organization.
Yeah, and there's two reasons really, well, lots of reasons, but two main ones jump out. One is I can give all the techniques in the world, and I will happily chat about endless meeting techniques and things that are definitely useful for most organizations. But in the end, every organization has a unique set of valuable problems. So what really is slowing you down in one organization will be slightly different from what's really slowing people down about meetings in another organization. And the things that will work will just be different. So what I see is in my clients is as they take on some of my principles and techniques on a small scale, they'll adapt them in a way that works and lands perfectly for their team. So for example, I worked with one organization recently with lots of technical people, and they took the principle of having a kind of minimum viable meeting invitation, and they turned it into a they coded it with Visual Basic and turned it into something like a sort of prototype in Excel. And I thought, wow, I would never have thought to do that. But for them in their world, that was the completely logical thing to do with it, and that caught on really well. Because that's what, and ultimately that will be turned into a web-based platform or a kind of add-on to their calendar functionality, but they prototyped it in a way that made sense to them. So So that's the first thing. Things only catch on if they solve the specific high value problems that you have, and in a way that completely mirrors your way of working and your workflow and what is obviously helpful for you. The second reason is that is how change happens in the wild. Now, I don't need to talk to your listeners about the wild. We force these corporate and, very top down, linear, high control methods on what is essentially a wild population of people. They say, your biggest asset, the most enormously ridiculously large thing on your balance sheet goes down the stairs or out of the lift every single day and out of your office and may not ever come back again. People are wild in the best possible way, and most people won't change their habits because they're told to. They'll change them because they've seen something that's shifted their thinking a bit, and then they saw an example of it, and then they tried it a bit and it was really useful, or they did it differently themselves. And that is how change is happening across social media from very humble beginnings. People who would never have had a voice or a platform are able to create these enormous shifts in our social culture through this technique. And that is what we are borrowing from, not because it's new, but because it's old. That is how things change in the wild.
This sort of behavioral shift. There's a great video you might have seen on YouTube of someone at a music festival kind of dancing on their own on the side of the hill, like how you start a movement. And they're sort of dancing, just they don't care who's watching, and then one or two people join in and they encourage others to come. And within about a minute, it's a stampede of people going towards and wanting to be part of that. And I think the message that I saw was a TED talk was, it's not the first dancer, it's the people that join that first dancer
First follower.
and encourage others.
So I think that's the David Silver video, and they played it just before I did my TEDx talk again 10 years ago. So it's one I'm very, very fond of, and exactly that. So the first thing I do in every organization is find, usually it's not just one person, but there's some research into this, that the number of people you need to start a change in an organization as a proportion of the whole population is incredibly small, as long as they're loud enough. It's really small because they will get a few other forward-thinking, right direction facing people to join in. As you say, it's the first follower.
Yeah, first of all,
The
that's
person
it.
that says that person is not an idiot. That person is not a a complete maverick, but they are they're right, because I'm endorsing them. And then other people will join in. And that's the basis of social contagion, and we're trying to use that principle. And in the end, people will do stuff if it's useful enough, if it saves them time, solves a problem, like I can't get my people and my team to do this. Oh wow, that really helped. If it makes them look good, if it helps them with their career, people will do stuff. And that's why we start by solving small problems that genuinely matter to people.
And just touching on 10 years there as well in your TED talk, I remember it well. I remember watching it at home. I plugged my iPhone into my TV so I could watch it, and it's still out there and worth watching again. It's amazing. But it touches on like us, and we've known each other for 10 years now. And as we kind of lurch towards the end of our podcast, I just wanted to, well, to A, to thank you for everything you've done for Conservation Careers. Like really, 10 years ago, you helped to get us off the ground. You provided a year's training to us as an early stage business, and mentoring and guidance and support and resources and everything else. And we wouldn't be where we are if it wasn't for you. So, Carrie, thank you so much.
Oh,
And
well,
just,
Nick, amazing.
well, you know.
I feel the tiniest part of an incredible journey, but it was a huge privilege to be, that you trusted us with your time and energy at that crucial stage.
Yeah, well, thank you. And almost every day, the teachings that I learned 10 years ago help me today. So yeah. But in that context of you, and we haven't talked about your business acumen and background, you've had an incredible career, and we haven't got time, unfortunately, to go through all that. I'd love to. But you are very effective as an entrepreneur, as someone who creates value through enterprise. That's also a kind of key theme that within our audience, we have people who are really passionate about conservation. They see solutions that could even be business solutions. I call them eco enterprises, they're ecopreneurs. If someone sat there with an idea that could create profit and purpose, which to me is the holy grail because it can scale, have you got any advice for people like that who just want, who've got an idea and they want to get it off the ground?
I think it's challenging times for that kind of organization. I think there are some enormous questions, and a lot of interest and gaining real support is challenging, i.e., money, customers, backers. So I think I guess the sort of the thinking process for me is, how can I quickly make sure that I'm not being affected by the interest of people who think it's a good idea, because all of these ideas are good ideas. None, there are no bad people trying to make money out of the, well, I'm sure there are a couple of bad people, but people in this audience are bright, energetic, go-getting people coming up with good solutions to environmental problems. Most of them won't be those profitable, purposeful, scalable things. So what we're looking for at the very outset is, who will pay money to make sure this succeeds, or and vice versa, what combination of benefits and functionality do I need to create that someone will pay for? And the question being, like, who cares if I succeed? So it doesn't necessarily, yet customers are brilliant, but it's not in this space, it's not always customers who will pay for you first, but who will care enough for you to succeed? Another part of the value chain. It could be NGO money. It could, who cares if I succeed, and how can I get them on board? I want to prove that link really quickly, because without that is the kind of lifeblood, isn't it? And without that, it's very hard to get off the ground. And the way to access that is to have a very crisp sequential story. And I know people talk about storytelling all the time, and I'm sort of tired of hearing that word, but what I mean by that is to be able to say, this is the specific problem in the world. This is exactly the place it manifests itself in the ecosystem chain, whatever. This is why nobody succeeded it. It's what people have tried. This is what hasn't succeeded so far. What I'm doing is this, and it's better and different because this. And you want to be like tick, ding, ding, tick, 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 tick through all these things. Everyone's like, wow, that you need the most enormous degree of travel between problem and solution, if you see what I mean. And then you need to convince them. The final part of the story is, and I'm the person to do this because I'm uniquely qualified at this, or there's no one else in the world who knows more about this, or I'm plugged into these places here, or I've got one foot in here and one foot in there, or I'm at the perfect stage of my career, or whatever. They need to know that you are. They need to think, this is a fantastic idea, and I just think that person's going to do it. That's what I would do before anything else.
I love it. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. It also makes me feel like that process could almost be applied to a job seeker when speaking to
Definitely,
employers too, right?
definitely. Yeah, because what is a job other than a kind of work product? You are the work product that you are inserting into a particular kind of chain ecosystem, which just happens to be the wrapper for that is job, and the ecosystem is company
You're just
or
selling
charity.
yourself at that point rather than an idea.
So you are positioning yourself.
Carrie, it's been so nice talking. Thank you so much for sharing your precious time with us. We really appreciate it. Is there anything else that you want to share with our listeners? And if people want to find out more about Fewer, Faster, Bolder, where should they go? How can they get in touch?
So I think so one final thing to share is, I want people to be hopeful about meetings, and I want people to see me not as the kind of meeting suck person, but like the meetings can be amazing. I want to reframe meetings not as this kind of time drain, frustration, power fest, but as the high point in our careers where we get to do amazing things with brilliant people. That's the reframe. So if that sounds interesting, then the main thing I'd encourage people to do is to sign up for my weekly friction-free email. So it's my one sort of powerful collaboration idea unpacked every single week for people doing meetings. You don't need to be a senior leader or anything like that. People going to meetings, people running meetings. And that is a place where I share a premium idea every single week.
Great.
And you
And I
can
find on your website.
find it on the website or say fewerfasterbolder.com/friction-free.
Amazing. Amazing. And we'll put obviously a link in our show notes as well. I follow you closely on LinkedIn too, and you share lots of value on LinkedIn too. So that might be another place people could kind of rootle you out. Yeah.
Definitely.
Once again, Carrie, it's been wonderful having your podcast. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me. Thanks, Nick.
Thank you. Okay, I hope you enjoyed that, everyone. If you did, then please do hit the subscribe button to get notified of new episodes as they drop. And also, please give us a rating or a review because it really helps us to get in front of more people, and we really enjoy reading them all. As you'll have heard, our podcasts are now recorded in front of a live audience who sit in and listen to the chat. And then after the mics are turned off, they get a chance to talk to the host, to share their thoughts, and also to ask questions. It's a really great format. If you'd like to be in the audience, all you need to do is join the Conservation Careers Academy. Now, in the Conservation Careers Academy, you'll get full access to the world's biggest conservation job board, listing over 15,000 jobs, volunteer, and internships across the globe each year. You'll also enjoy access to our amazing CC Pro private members community with regular events, networking, and support. Plus, you'll get full access to our growing library of career-boosting resources, guides, and templates. And best of all, it only costs a few dollars, euros, or pounds per month to join the Academy. Now, to find out more, please visit conservation-careers.com/academy or simply click the join button at the top of our website. See you on the inside.